Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this lecture in the series put on by the Law Department of the school as part of the centenary celebrations of London School of Economics. Some 40 years ago, in 1955, the British Broadcasting Corporation thought they'd like to put on a series of lectures about famous judges of the past. Who better, they thought, than to ask distinguished judges of the present to participate in this. And so the Director General wrote to the Lord Chancellor of the day, Lord Kilmure, and asked if it would be possible for some of Her Majesty's judges to give their thoughts on the great men, all men then, of the past. Well, Kilmure was a bit worried by this, so he consulted the Lord Chief Justice and the Master of the Rolls and the President of the Probate, Divorce and Admiralty Division, as was then, and they all agreed in the following terms, and includes one phrase which has become very famous, I think. He said, "The overriding consideration, in the opinion of myself and my colleagues, is the importance of keeping the judiciary in the country insulated from the controversies of the day. So long as a judge keeps silent, his reputation for wisdom and impartiality remains unassailable," presuming that he had one when he started. "It would, moreover, be inappropriate for the judiciary to be associated with any series of talks or anything which could be fairly interpreted as entertainment. It's undesirable for members of the judiciary to broadcast on the wireless or to appear on television or to other involvement in journalism." So the answer was that all suggestions of this, any requests which judges received, should be cleared with the Lord Chancellor and his department. Well then, 30 years later, in 1986, the Lord Chancellor was now Lord Hailsham, and the matter arose again. And this time he consulted everybody, so far as I can see. He said he'd consulted the judiciary of the Supreme Court and the circuit bench, whether he meant he really talked to everybody. Certainly it was wider than Kilmure's effort. And he said that, in fact, this had already happened on three previous occasions. He, after all, he had been Lord Chancellor off and on a rather long time, had consulted judges on this matter in 1971, in 1979, and in 1985. And the overwhelming consensus, he said, on all these occasions was that there should be no change in the arrangements and matters should all be fed through Lord Chancellor's department. That was 1985. In 1987, in November, we had a new Lord Chancellor, Lord Mackay, and he, rather as a sort of flick of the wrist, just abandoned the whole practice and said that was a lot of nonsense and we weren't going to have that anymore, decided to treat judges as grown-up men and women, and said that you decide whether or not, in your discretion, it makes sense for you to talk about this, that, or the other. Now, the heavens didn't fall in as a result of this concession, as it were, though perhaps because the judges were at this time conscious of the generosity of the Lord Chancellor, they turned on him almost as one man and bit him in the head. Because this was the time when the Lord Chancellor has introduced a number of reforms which he thought would be good for the legal profession, and he was attacked vigorously by judges on a matter which I would have thought was highly controversial. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that they were wrong to do so, nor indeed that there's anything to be lost by the present frankness with which we now exist. So, at the moment, although, as I say, the heavens haven't fallen in on this great freedom, we haven't been... There has been a change, and there have been a lot of arguments on all sorts of matters, certainly on matters which I would call political, like whether or not we should incorporate the European Convention on Human Rights, which judges take part in that debate with great alacrity and enthusiasm, and practically all of them, I think, have got it wrong, but this is only a matter of opinion. And there are other matters also. There's now a move at the moment, both among the highest in the judiciary and the lower ranks of the judiciary, to suggest that maybe it might be a good idea, not perhaps tomorrow, but in the fullness of time, or like day after tomorrow, that judges should be able to set aside Acts of Parliament on the ground that they said certain things which the judges thought would be undesirable. It's in that sort of context and in that climate that we are so glad to have Mr. Justice Sedley to address us tonight.
Professor Griffith, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, I had better start by admitting that my links with the London School of Economics are familial rather than institutional. But my father read economics here in the 1920s, at a time when the Students' Union elected its first Labour Party president, and the Daily Mail called for the withdrawal of all the school's subsidies. He managed to graduate in 1929, which was a year in which economists were not in great demand. In my student generation, of course, the Daily Mail has found itself unexpectedly vindicated as the barricades went up in Houghton Street and Bernard Shaw's scheme to reform English orthography was triumphantly carried into effect with a placard announcing that education was a right, not a P-R-I-V-A-L-I-G-E. And so it's pleasant to be... What's wrong with that? It's pleasant to be carried back here by Times Whirligig in a month when the Daily Mail is thinking of supporting the Labour Party with a platform or a rope, one will have to see. And when the restless urge of economists to adjust theory to reality has given us in the 1980s and 90s the same economic orthodoxies as gave my father's world its worst ever slump. And when students call their brokers on mobile telephones between lectures delivered by teachers whose only hope of temporal gain is a modest royalty on an overpriced textbook, Whirligig of Time certainly brings in its revenges. I'm, of course, tonight, Professor Griffith, ignoring Viscount Kilmuir's warning, but you need have no fear that you're going to experience anything approaching entertainment. There is, however, no historic irony at all in my gratitude to you, Professor Griffith, not only for your introduction tonight, but for the contribution that you've made in a long and productive working life to the study of public law, not simply as an artifact of textual study, but as both a product and a shaping factor of an entire society. It's in that three-dimensional spirit that I turn to my topic, autonomy and the rule of law. We're by now well past the era when law could be perceived and taught as a self-sufficient and self-referential set of rules, elucidated where necessary by textual scrutiny and judicial precedent, and applied to facts ascertained by a judge with an aquiline eye, sharpened to the point of infallibility by years of experience at the bar, for falsehood and prevarication, or by a jury of English yeomen with very much the same virtues. Such an account of autonomy required a range of unspoken assumptions, most of them lying beyond my present topic, about the nature not only of law, but of adjudication. I mention them in order to draw the contrast with what I want to consider. The need for a society which acknowledges the rule of law to have an independent legal system, and the need in a democracy for such a legal system to be responsive to social concerns without being driven by them. The two are in necessary and perpetual tension. Further, the legal system itself is called on to respect many other autonomies, ministerial discretions prominent among them, without forfeiting its own constitutional obligation to keep the acts of executive government, lower courts, and public bodies of all kinds within the law. To postulate an independent judiciary as an essential element in the rule of law is both to state the obvious and to beg a vast question, independent of whom and of what. Not beholden to governments for its tenure, that goes without saying. Not open to pressure or lobbying in relation to its decisions, certainly. Free of preconceptions, well, yes, if they're the wrong sort and bear on the issues to be tried, but nobody except the guilty wants judges who lack a preconceived hostility to violence or dishonesty. So the desired Olympian detachment is required to be diluted with what is, after all, if you recall your classical mythology, an equally Olympian capacity for involvement. problem is to agree what kind of involvement and in what cases it's called for. There's no disagreement that detachment is a necessary quality in an adjudicator. Detachment is what is theatrically portrayed by the use of insignia and garments which render the judge, and hence the judge's pronouncements, impersonal. From the fearsome masks and elaborate costumes worn by the night-visiting judge enforcers of parts of pre-colonial Africa, which you may know are to be replicated in the third millennium AD by Judge Dredd and his peers, to the regalia worn for centuries before wigs became fashionable by the King's justices as the High Sheriff's pikemen and trumpeters escorted them with chaplain and hangman into the assize towns, and on from there to the more modest varieties of costumes still worn by most judiciaries in the world, the need for judges not only to be, but to be seen to be, in important ways detached and impersonal, is acknowledged, even if the need for them to be feared is now in doubt. But there is near unanimity today about an equal and in many ways opposite need, that judges should be, I quote, in touch, should have, if not hands-on experience of other jobs and ways of life than their own, at least a real awareness of how the other 99% live. I don't think you would find a judge anywhere in the UK today who disagreed. But the adjustment of the balance between detachment and awareness, a truly problematical process to which I want to return in a moment, is bedeviled by a combination of the length and depth of judicial history and the brevity of the concentration span of some journalists. A judge who knows the answer perfectly well asks tongue-in-cheek, "Who are the Beatles?" because the traditional model of judicial independence requires him judicially not to know. A press which happens to know who the Beatles are, but no longer has the remotest notion of the received model of judicial independence, guffaws not with, but at the judge. This mightn't matter if it were not part of something which has now become epidemic, a sustained public critique of the judiciary, which descends at times from argument to abuse, and which has included in recent weeks the use by a columnist of the words termite and weevil to describe a judge whose decision about the Home Secretary's timetable for considering the release of IRA long-term prisoners, a decision which the Home Secretary has not so far sought to appeal against, the journalist disagreed with. One can't help noticing that the authors of this and similar tirades appear not to have read the judgments they are attacking, or if they have read them, not to have understood them. This is not to say that a judgment, once read and understood, is beyond criticism, but it is to point out that a society which takes it as normal that judges could be personally vilified because a paper does not like the outcome of what they decide is taking very serious risks with the rule of law. Ostensibly, it's a fair comment that the media, as their name suggests, are mere messengers, and that we have no right to kill them if we don't like their message. Even so, if the messenger on arrival is hysterical, garbles the message, and is sick on the carpet, it's not easy to see why one shouldn't offer a word or two of respectful criticism. The prime virtue of administering justice and giving reasons in public is that the content and quality of the reasoning can be criticised and, if appropriate, appealed, and that if the reasoning is sound, attention can be directed to whether the law needs to be changed. It may be, too, that occasionally attention comes legitimately to rest on the public qualities of a particular judge, but journalists and editors have to be capable of differentiating, as on the present evidence, not all of them are, between a judge whose input into a case is, in their reasoned view, unacceptable, and one whose decisions, though transparent and conscientiously arrived at, are unwelcome. It would be idle to ignore an incipient resentment of judicial review, which has become audible, alongside the much greater general welcome which press and public still accord it. If, as critics now suggest, there are signs of damage to the structural relationship between Parliament, ministers, and the courts, it is in part because the constitutional nexus between these three elements of the state has become either indistinct or misunderstood. The law of our organic constitution is inevitably, for the most part, a descriptive account of how we manage ourselves, and the description today must undoubtedly include a role for judicial review of administrative action, which is both larger in scope and deeper in its penetration than what we have previously known. But this is still a quantitative and not a qualitative change. The qualitative change, as it almost was the exponential growth of departmental power, practically unchecked by judicial review from the time of the First World War to the 1960s. Since then, we have witnessed, in truth, no more than a reassertion of the relationship established in the course of the 17th century between executive government and the law, a relationship which insists, certainly, that the courts will respect the integrity of all executive decisions taken within the limits of the executive's legal powers, but which also insists that what the limits of the executive's powers are is for the law and not for ministers to say. The law, here as everywhere else, is not the mere diktat of the judges. It's the unique amalgam of statute and common law which makes up our public jurisprudence, giving priority always to Parliament's prescriptions and supplementing these, where to do so will not frustrate the parliamentary intent, with what a Victorian judge called the justice of the common law. When a divisional court of the Queen's Bench struck down the Foreign Secretary's decision to subsidise the Pergau Dam project, it was applying the terms of an Act of Parliament. When the Criminal Injuries Compensation Board is directed by the court to reconsider a refusal to compensate a victim of crime, it is because the board has failed to adhere to the terms of reference given to it by the Home Secretary under the royal prerogative. When a court decides that legislation, perhaps even primary legislation, is invalid because it conflicts with European community law, it is not because Europhilia has taken possession of the bench, but because Parliament in 1972 legislated for it to happen. This precisely is what the rule of law is about. The power of the executive to determine most of what Parliament enacts is a fact of modern history, but it doesn't excuse those who confuse the will of ministers with the will of Parliament and criticise judicial supervision of the former as if it were an interference with the latter. The distinction between ministerial and parliamentary power and the separation of both from the judicial power is the very separation of powers which democracies have for more than two centuries taken to be the foundation of the rule of law. Apart from its constitutional ineptness, the demand that judges should resume their Olympian distance makes an odd bedfellow with the equally loud complaint, illustrated by the constant recycling of a handful of yellowing clippings, that they are out of touch with real life. I don't suppose the critics would be any happier with a judge who expressed the view ex cathedra that the Beatles had peaked with Sergeant Pepper, or that at least you could discern a words and a tune in their songs, unlike Meatloaf and so on. But in the occasional case, if it happens, it's usually a rape or indecency case, where a judge does publicly make a remark which is considered unacceptable. It's impossible to translate judicial independence into a gag on public comment. Indeed, I wouldn't want to leave the proposition in a defensive or negative form. It must be a healthy thing for the rule of law that the standards of judgment which a legal system brings to bear should reflect, or at least not defy, a society's changing consensus on issues which are not purely legal. That today judges are formally trained at all. The Judicial Studies Board is 16 years old now and has a budget in seven figures, and that they are given training which seeks to examine inherited assumptions and to bring other disciplines into difficult areas of decision-making is itself a product of a positive and beneficial contraction of the accepted boundaries of judicial independence. The judge who can't be told anything because he knows it all, and who was perceived until not that long ago as the ideal strong judge, precisely because of his detachment, survives more in recollection than in reality. In my early years at the bar, a full generation ago, the judge I dreaded was not the sort who on one occasion accepted a tale of quite extraordinary coincidences with the proposition, like the theologian, credo quia impossibile, but the one who reckoned that he could always tell a wrong'un. Because the wrong'un is a stereotype. The witness who acts shifty or cocky and is therefore lying. His stereotypical opposite, the witness who delivers a steady tale of linear cogency and probably is lying. It was a Dickensian worldview which mimicked the categoric certitudes of law as it was once taught and learned. The retired judge of the Court of Appeal, who said to me not long ago, "The longer I sat on the bench, the less certain I became that I could tell truth from falsehood," was expressing not despair, but caution. And one only has to spend a few hours with an organisation such as Victim Support to realise how much lawyers and judges need to know of the effect of criminal process on innocent participants. It's been the remarkable achievement of the Judicial Studies Board, without provoking any mutiny in defence of the old model of judicial autonomy, to embark on and develop a series of programmes for enlarging the skills and knowledge of adjudicators from tribunal chairmen and lay magistrates to High Court judges. It's been done without any statutory underpinning and without therefore removing from the judiciary their constitutional responsibility for managing themselves. It is distant from the comprehensive sweep of institutions like the École Nationale de la Magistrature in France, as the English system itself is from the Napoleonic. One downside of our autonomous arrangement may well be the loss of the potential value of having an institutional academic base for judicial studies. Another, to which more than one judge has publicly drawn attention in the recent past, is that it places judicial independence to an extent in the hands of executive government, in whose entire discretion the resources for judicial self-management lie. It might be that what the Judicial Studies Board puts on its syllabus wouldn't satisfy the get-real chorus of critics, but the fact is that we don't need to be instructed in the philosophy of Alf Garnett in whatever accent it is propounded. We need to know far more than we do, and often than outside specialists know either, about the subtleties and intractabilities of human conduct and the background and ramifications of public issues which tend to be two-dimensionally canvassed in court. Moreover, what is to be learned and whether the judges are sufficiently receptive to it will remain problematical. They may be tutored by psychologists and psychiatrists about child abuse symptomatology or false memory syndrome, or by physicians and surgeons on repetitive strain injury, or other topics on which specialists themselves are uncertain or divided. They may be resistant to new views, for example, about gender, a topic which was flagged up by the Royal Commission on Criminal Procedure as one on which work was needed, and in relation to which the vocal critics of judicial aloofness will no doubt start complaining instead about the incursion of political correctness. And axiomatically, judges can't be dictated to. Nevertheless, what matters is that we now accept that they can and should learn about more things than black-letter law. If Lord Wolfe's proposals for saving time and cost through hands-on judicial management of cases are going to require the teaching of managerial skills which are not at present part of the judicial stock in trade, it will be to the Judicial Studies Board that we look to provide them. What we haven't come to terms with are the implications of this change, both for the process of adjudication and for the rule of law itself. So long as adjudication is confined to the application of received law to ascertained facts, error is by definition that which is overturned on appeal, and the law by definition whatever the highest court for the time being says it is. Here it's possible, at least theoretically, to divest the argument and the issues of their social and moral penumbra and to articulate a decision in terms which do not stray outside the language of the law. But once the topic of adjudication moves outside the region of received law, it becomes much harder to clothe the decision in purely legal language. Probably the best example has been the successive decisions in the Tony Bland case, in which the courts were faced with an issue which only they could decide, but to which the law afforded no obvious answer. I would venture the view that they acquitted themselves very well in grappling with a series of profound moral and ethical questions, speaking, it may well be, less as jurists than as thinking members of society, but equipped as other members of society are not, with decisive powers of adjudication. There are plenty of people who would dispute this, and it's impossible not to speculate what the equally conscientious judgment of a Roman Catholic judge would have been in the Bland case. There's as much, however, to be learned from another case which took the courts into unaccustomed territory, Victoria Gillick's attempt to prevent the Department of Health making contraceptive advice available to girls below the age of consent. When one reads the differences of judicial opinion in the House of Lords, which was divided 3-2, one sees how the pressure for the judges to get real encounters the uncomfortable fact that we don't all perceive real life in the same way. It happened, but it was not ineluctable, that the division of opinion in the House not only reflected the undoubted division of opinion in society, but that it came out on balance in the way it did. In spite of all this, and even though the endless accusation that the judges are out of touch comes principally from a stratum of journalists who themselves ask more foolish questions in a week than the average judge asks in a year, an expectation that tomorrow's judges will and should know, and show that they know, what goes on in the rest of society is now very nearly ubiquitous. It's worth bearing in mind that the expectation is not risk-free. There may turn out to be something to be said for the traditional judge who, whatever his or her notions of the world may be, listens to the evidence and limits the decision to what it discloses. The problem with the model is that evidence is conventionally limited to immediate factual issues. And we do need, I think, to look with a more Catholic eye on the use, especially in public law cases, of amicus and Brandeis briefs on the American model, so that without going beyond material canvassed publicly in court, the judges can come to a decision informed by research and submissions on the social and other ramifications of an issue which has been formally joined between two contending parties. I recall with regret that a petition by the Children's Legal Centre to be allowed to submit arguments to the House of Lords in the Gillick case, a case after all being fought between a public moralist and a government department about the interests of an important social group which itself had no voice in the proceedings, was turned down. In a handful of other cases, our courts have heard amicus or third-party arguments, but randomly and without any governing principle. The organisation Justice will shortly be publishing a report which commends a fuller and more systematic use of this power, which the courts undoubtedly possess, and I hope it will be heeded. It recognises in particular the need for judges to be well and widely informed without becoming trapped in partial data or idiosyncratic views. It's in public law cases that these needs are becoming most acute. For reasons which I hope will one day be accounted for historically, the growth of judicial review of administrative action over the last two decades shows no sign of slowing down. A number of these cases call in question the legality of major policy decisions or public initiatives on grounds not simply of statutory construction, although this is often central, but of the extent and degree of the effect of the challenged action. In order to try the issues, for example, on Greenpeace's challenge to Thorpe, judges have to become experts ad hoc. As citizens, they may have their own views about nuclear power, but for this very reason, the more they can learn about the facts and issues from evidence openly debated in court, the less room there is for private assumptions to contribute to the outcome. It is outcomes, of course, which understandably interest the public, not the reasoning which has led the court to them. I've argued elsewhere that it's mistaken for lawyers to regard this concern as simply an uneducated concentration on consequence to the exclusion of principle, for principles exist in order to determine or influence outcomes. But as the law enters new territory, received principles do become poorer guides. Moreover, it's idle to deny that judges are as concerned with outcomes as anybody else. But where the public is fully entitled to say, if this is the outcome, there must be something wrong with the principles, it's to principles that the rule of law, for better or for worse, holds the judge. Between principle and outcome, nevertheless, there is sometimes a substantial margin of appreciation in places wide enough to enable the judge to elect between outcomes. In such cases, which are quite often high-profile and path-breaking cases, it isn't necessarily healthy to pretend that the conclusion has been inexorably determined by prior principle, which is the traditional rhetoric of judgment. It may well be better that the courts should feel free to set out the range of considerations which has influenced their choice of result. If these become topics of criticism and debate on a scale which exceeds anything accorded to purely legal issues, this is no more than the public is entitled to and than the courts ought to expect in an open society. In places, of course, explicit decision by outcome already happens, but it tends to be only in safe places, such as where the court is declining to follow the literal words of a statute because of the absurdity or unacceptability of the consequences, or where the merits and justice of the case point very clearly to the choice of outcome. And here, no public debate is ignited. But one of the dangers of pursuing omniscience is that one catches an illusion of omnicompetence. The courts are not and may not legitimately become omnicompetent. It's not simply that adversarial processes are wholly unsuited to a great many of the issues which today end up in court, making alternative dispute resolution an urgent social priority. It's that there are many subjects on which judicial adjudication is irrelevant or unhelpful or unnecessary. One starts with recognisably non-justiciable issues, like the libel action brought by a plaintiff against someone who had disputed that he was the Messiah. Beyond these lie issues which the courts will decide in the absence of any other taker, but for which they are not a natural or ideal forum. Let me return to the Tony Bland case, in which I've suggested that the courts acquitted themselves well. Theoretically, one could set up an ethical panel of lay people and experts to decide such questions, but their credentials would be almost as debatable as the judges. The more real question is whether the courts should recognise the autonomy of the existing actors, the family, the doctors, and so decline jurisdiction. Not long ago, the courts in this country might very well have done just this, holding that their task was confined to adjudicating on any legal process brought before them on conventional grounds after the thing was done. The doctors would then have had to choose between the course dictated by medical conscience and the near certainty that someone would try to prosecute them for murder. Whether the ultimate decision were then the Attorney General's in the form of a nolle prosequi, or the judge's in the form of a directed acquittal, or a charge to the jury, or an appellate decision following a conviction, there would be no way of ring-fencing the autonomy of the decision-makers. Between these two poles of the non-justiciable and the inexorably justiciable, there lies the great mass of administrative tribunals and similar bodies, which determine millions of issues a year between them. Some of these now possess a statutory autonomy with their own appellate systems, feeding only at a late stage and a high stage into the judicial system, the Social Security scheme, for example. But others, notably the immigration control system, have limited rights of appeal, driving immigrants and asylum seekers in large numbers to resort to the courts for judicial review as their only means of challenging adverse decisions, many of which spell tragedy for the individuals concerned. The courts, in their turn, are presented with a major problem: how to respect the specialised function of the immigration adjudicators and at the same time not abdicate their own constitutional function of taking a hard look at the legality and the integrity of reasoning of the adjudicators' decisions. There is no formulaic solution. Both elements have to have weight. But I have to say that I have little instinctive sympathy with the view, which perhaps was more heard a generation ago than it is now, that such adjudicative processes may legitimately develop their own cultures and standards and expect the courts to respect these. Now, this may sound very much like the sense of judicial omnicompetence that I was warning against a moment ago, but I draw attention to the dangers of letting judicial review slip backwards. If one set of tribunals can safely and unreviewably develop a practice of, say, holding the parties rigidly to prior statements of their case, or never adjourning where someone is ill unless a doctor gives oral evidence about it, then another can equally safely develop a practice. In many cases, in fact, they would simply be reverting to the old practice of taking guidance from a Department of State as to how they should decide cases. The courts would be faced with lowering the standards for all tribunals, or else explaining why they're prepared to accept in one tribunal what they will not accept in another. The same would have to apply to magistrates' courts, with the real risk that differential standards of justice would come into existence for different petty sessional areas. I once went to Chester to conduct an appeal against a binding over order made by Ellesmere Port justices, and I was interrupted as I opened my first authority by the judge saying, "Oh, Mr. Sedley, that was a London case. We do things differently in Chester." Now, this sort of thing, however benignly it's said, can't be right. Po-faced and inimical to diversity it may sound, but the rule of law does call for a reasonable uniformity of adjudicative standards. Within these standards, the courts can and do recognise that different issues and fact situations will produce different outcomes. But this is a corollary of the principle of consistency and not a negation of it. It does nevertheless represent, I accept, an assertion of judicial over-administrative autonomy in a respect which requires some historical modesty. Many of the principles enforced by courts of judicial review are standards of fairness, which we still dignify as natural justice. In truth, as a former vice-chancellor has pointed out, the closer you get to a state of nature, the less justice there is. The belief that what lawyers perceive as fairness is for that reason natural, that is to say, so fundamental as to require no justification, is not in the same class as the belief that a judge can always tell a wrong'un. But it remains the fact that plenty of domestic bodies whose decisions have been struck down by the courts for bias, for breach of natural justice, remain unable to comprehend why, for example, it was unacceptable to the judge that the accuser was sitting on the panel, or that the original decision-maker sat on the appeal board. They may well have believed that it was the best way of ensuring an informed decision. Nevertheless, the courts which today supply what Mr. Justice Byles in 1863 called the justice of the common law don't always remember that the court in which Mr. Justice Byles made his ringing pronouncement, the Court of Common Pleas, included the judge against whose decision the appeal had been brought. Standards, in other words, necessarily and healthily change as times change. What seems not to change is each society's reluctance to see its self-evident truths as artifacts of history, none the worse for it, but still creatures of time and place. So that, for example, the self-evident equality of all men could be announced 2 centuries ago, in all sincerity, by slaveholders, and in a declaration which went on to make it clear that Native Americans were also excluded from the self-evident fraternity of mankind. It's not an argument that standards should be abandoned, or that relativism makes them pointless, but that their mutability over the long term calls perhaps for some qualification to the assurance with which the courts speak what is constitutionally the last word to public administration, and even to private adjudicative bodies, about standards which, at least to lawyers, at least today, seem so natural as to be self-evident. I don't suggest for a moment that we should be retreating from the standards of fairness which our jurisprudence has built up, and which reflect a very large democratic consensus. What I am concerned to point out is that unless each of our present standards is understood and argued for, not merely accepted as natural, the possibility of future growth becomes compromised by the very strength and self-confidence of our present jurisprudence. It's noticeable that where 10 years ago Lord Diplock was able to contemplate the probability that proportionality would come to be a part of the public law vocabulary, more recent decisions have shown a tendency to reason from the premise that it isn't part of our law to the conclusion that it never can be. Now, there's a serious debate to be conducted about whether a doctrine of proportionality or review for error of fact would be an improper invasion of executive autonomy. But it would be a great pity if our common law system, with its unique capacity for adaptation and growth, were to become so self-assured that it was deaf to the debate. If, in addition, the monitoring of judicial performance reaches the head of the agenda, it'll be necessary to make careful distinctions between the value of feedback to any professionals who work largely on their own and the constitutional implications of surveillance superimposed on the public character of almost all adjudication. Well, it's probably axiomatic that there can be no fixed prescription for the balance between judicial autonomy and judicial responsiveness. One reason is that neither is in itself an absolute. No judge, especially not the occasional one who still insists that it is so, comes to the task of adjudication free of preconceptions, even if they're no more controversial than when the present Lord Chief Justice, as a judge of first instance, reacted with mild astonishment to a submission that music was an unnecessary luxury. But equally, unless the judiciary is to abdicate in favour of the most audible opinion formers, judgment can't be dictated by others. It's in relation to sentencing, which is not constitutionally the preserve of any one branch of the state, that the problem of sensitivity to the views of others is perhaps at its most acute. It's generally taken to be Parliament's business to prescribe the maximum penalties for crimes, to furnish the range of possible disposals, and to fix the Home Secretary's functions in relation to release from prison. Within this framework, judges are required to decide on sentence, attempting the daunting task of combining a detailed fit of penalty to the specific case with consistency between one case and another, attempting also to distinguish between necessary sensitivity to the impact of the crime and knee-jerk reaction to what often is a cause for real anger. Neither judges nor penologists have a unitary theory of sentencing. Penologists, because no single theory can explain the variety of sentences which are imposed. Judges, because it's the very ability to move between deterrence and correction, between justice and mercy, between anger and hope, which enables them to carry out the function in a way that a machine couldn't do. In cases of rape and domestic or racial violence or homicide, the judicial perception of gravity and mitigation has rightly changed and is still changing in response to perceptible shifts in public understanding or sympathy or anger. Such responsiveness to groundswells is a wholesome aspect of adjudication in a democratic society. It's a very different thing, however, from simply reacting to moral scares or instrumental polemics. Towards these, it's the judicial duty to be cautious and, if necessary, resistant, for to be compliant would be to abdicate the independence of judgment, the qualified autonomy that I've been speaking of, without which the rule of law risks becoming the rule of rhetoric. Thank you very much.
I rather seek to avoid the occasion when the chairman, you having given your warm reception to the speaker, then gets up, looks at the notes which he made 2 hours ago and took, and produces another set of adjectives, and then you all clap again. We are very grateful to you, sir. You, the audience, have shown your gratitude and your appreciation. And those of you now who are our guests and visitors may join us in the senior common room for a glass of wine.